people coming from Road Accident Fund, members of the society and members of the media, you are heartily welcomed. We are continuing with this. Last week we had several presentations. Even this week we are going to be having presentations, in particular from the actuaries, we believe that this is one of the things that will be able to assist us in focusing and in making sure that in the end we have the bill and the law that can be able to stand the test of time. Without much ado, I am going to be welcoming the Actuarial Society of South Africa to make a presentation. What we normally do is to give you 30 minutes of a presentation. If your 30 minutes is consumed and you haven't finished strictly 10 minutes for you to can be able to finalize everything that you're doing. And honorable members will also get a 30 minutes interaction between yourselves and the honorable members. An honorable member will ask a question, you will respond to that question just like that. We give them time, but within 30 to 40 minutes, we should be able to have done that. So this is how the proceedings will be going. You are heartily welcomed. The leader of the delegation, you will introduce your delegation and present. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and honourable members, thank you very much for the opportunity. So we represent the Actuarial Society of South Africa. My name is Wim Lewis. I'm the Chair of the Damages and Compensation Committee. My colleagues to my right, Neil and Cameron, actuary and also Damages Committee, and Ulata Tuzwa, student actuary and also a damages specialist. So today, as Madam Chair noted, we've got 30 minutes. It's a short period of time to provide the committee with a sense of a number of the issues that we think are worthy of further discussion and investigation. By no means are we comprehensive. We highlight a few common themes or central themes, perhaps with a few examples to illustrate those themes. In the discussion section, you're welcome to pose us with further questions. But in the 30 minutes, we merely try and convey a few key issues. Broadly, we're going to discuss issues relating to the design, to the costing, to the risk management of the scheme. Just a few introductory slides regarding the Actuarial Society, or ASSA. So we basically are a professional organization. We represent our members. It's a non-profit organization. We welcome interaction with issues regarding public interest. The Actuarial Society ensures the maintenance of high quality actuarial standards. We appreciate engagement in public debate and so forth. So furthermore, the structure or the broader structure is there on the slide at the moment. I don't want to go into too much detail, but just to emphasize that we've got a council that sets the strategic direction for the society, and various subcommittees. For instance, the damages committee is the one that we represent today, but there are various subcommittees and practice areas represented within the actual society. Our current president is Mr. Peter Withy, and the president-elect is Mr. Lusani Mulausi. They both tender their apologies for not being here today. They both are attending the International Congress of Actuaries in Berlin that's currently running. So as I said, the council sets our strategic direction. A couple of the main focus areas currently are listed on the slide there, topics like transformation, education, and so forth. Specifically for today, we would be probably acting the fourth bullet point regarding public interest, comment on public issues, research into those types of issues and so forth. I just want to also note that there is three handouts for each of the committee members. We've got a copy of the slides, a copy with notes and also some further background on the actuarial society. So I'd like to hand over now to my colleagues, which will look at a few broader issues regarding the design, and after that I'll look at the prediction of costs and issues, topics around that, as well as risk management. Okay, so over to Nilan.
Good morning, Madam Chair, honourable members. Thank you for inviting us. I will start by outlining the key differences between the Road Accident Fund, RAF, and the Road Accident Benefit Scheme, RABS. Some of the impacts of these differences will be discussed at a later stage in the presentation, as time permits. I'm sure that we are all aware of the first difference, the fault-based versus no-fault-based, and the intentions to increase the number of claims while significantly reducing the litigation costs. Another difference under the RAF, there's lump sum compensation, whereas under RABS, there will be regular payments that will be made. And this, if you consider a claimant might receive one or two payments under the Road Accident Fund, there might be hundreds of payments per claimant under the Road Accident Benefit Scheme. Under the RAF, each beneficiary's particular career path and earnings path is going to be considered, whereas under the RAB scheme, it is a specific set of formulae that will be applied to all the claimants. Further, the potential career progressions and general earnings inflation that is allowed for under the RAF will not be allowed for under RABS, where only the income and support level at the date of accident or the date of injury is taken into account, and the inflationary increases will not be guaranteed. In terms of the benefits, the loss of earnings and loss of support components of the Road Accident Fund will be broadly replaced by income support benefit and family support benefit, the ISB and FSB. Medical costs will be replaced with healthcare services. These all have notable impacts on the relative costs of the two systems, but the chief change or the chief difference in benefits is the existence of the general damages under the Road Accident Fund and not being present at all under the Road Accident Benefit Scheme. Another marked change is the proposed introduction of a minimum benefit level equal to the average annual national income, the ARNI, which does not exist in the RAF system. There are also subtle yet far-reaching differences in applying the current RAF cap. Under the RAF system, it is applied to the losses, the actual losses themselves, but under the RABS, it is proposed to only apply to the beneficiary's pre-accident income. Regarding the funding of the two systems, the RAF is funded pay-as-you-go, and the RABS is proposed to be pre-funded. There's not sufficient time in this presentation to examine all the impacts of all these differences, so we've just chosen to focus on a handful of the issues, but please feel free to engage with us after the presentation on any issues that we do not cover in detail yet. So the first broad design issue that we'd like to highlight is the potentially large moral hazard risk that could be introduced as an unintended consequence of the RABS proposal. Moral hazard refers to the concept that individuals will engage in more risky behavior if there are insured benefits on offer and that they do not have to contribute, or they have no financial cost to themselves, and which they can obtain with regardless of their actions. RABS would function in part as an insurance scheme. So for parties that individuals that earn in between the minimum benefit of the ARNI and and the maximum benefit of the cap, they will receive a part compensation. And the layer, the claimants that fall in between no income, unemployed, and the minimum benefit, the RABS will act as a social welfare system. There are big uncertainties and hence risks around the impact of the switching to the no-fault system, while at the same time introducing the minimum benefit of the ARNI. These mean that the RABS would offer significantly higher benefits to a large portion of the population than are available under the current social welfare system. So consider anyone earning significantly less than the ARNI, say consider the unemployed. I mean, we know that's a notable proportion of our country. Under RABS, there will be a significant incentive introduced for people to effect scenarios that trigger these claims, targeting the minimum benefit offered, and these would also be possibly made more easy to effect given the no-fault principle. In fact, there are actually no known examples of implementing this no-fault type of system in a country with employment as high as 25% or greater. So we definitely recommend that this potential moral hazard should be managed and or mitigated. Some possibilities would include rather dealing with the low earners involved in accidents or the unemployed under normal social welfare system, or perhaps providing the minimum benefits under RABS to be, instead of in line with the average annual national income, rather something more in line with a disability grant. And perhaps another option would be to put protocols into place to identify and exclude claims that have arisen from moral hazard. Next, we'd like to give you a few scenarios that highlight the kinds of impacts on subgroups if the RABS is introduced in its current proposed form. RABS aims to provide increased benefits to the poorer sections of the population, and although this will be true to some extent, particularly in respect of the unemployed, it should be noted that various subgroups, including our fellow citizens from low socioeconomic backgrounds, are potentially worse off under RABS than under RAF. Firstly, ask you to consider a person who was employed and accruing a pension and then is in an accident and can no longer work as a result. This is the first picture there. And if you look at the black lines, those represent the income. Or maybe I should do it on this side. The black lines represent the income that has been lost as a result of the accident. The gray bars represent the pension that has been lost as a result of the accident. Adding those up gives you the claim that you would get under the current RAF system of what income and pension has been lost. Under RABS, by comparison, the red bars, which is the RABS claim, the amounts claimed at each time would be significantly lower. Firstly, because of the 75% being applied. Secondly, it could be further lower if annual inflationary increases are not granted. And then, of course, it's the RABS benefit ceases at age 60. So what we could find and what is a concern is that there will be savings under RABS, but from age 60 onwards, there could be an offsetting cost getting added to the social welfare system. Next, I'd like to discuss the next example is for a widower or a widow, a surviving spouse of someone who's been killed in an accident. They again, the same applies. The black and grey bars represent what support has been lost by the surviving spouse, and so under the RAF system, that would be the amount that would be claimed for. Under the RAV system, the claim will cease after 15 years, and so I guess the danger here is that for low earning or unemployed or unemployable surviving spouses, especially if they're young at the time of the accident or the loss of their partner, they could be significantly worse off under RAVs. Children as a group, they currently constitute about a third of, or more than a third of the road accident claimants, and they are generally worse off under RAVs than under RAF. This slide shows a comparison between adult claimants versus child claimants. As it can be seen, on the child side, whether you're potentially going to be a low earner or someone earning below the minimum benefit of the ARNI of the average annual national income, or whether you're going to be earning higher than that amount, it doesn't make a difference to the size of the benefit that you'll receive from RABS. This is in contrast to the adult claimants, where if you are earning above the ARNI, this will be taken into account when you are receiving compensation. So tertiary students would be a good case study, interesting case study. So a student that has been involved in an accident maybe just prior to commencing their first job, if the accident had occurred 1 month later, they would be getting this big block here extra, just with just a month difference in the accident. They'd either be getting this or that. So there's definitely these subgroups of people that are going to be experiencing some anomalous effects. These chosen examples that we've shown so far are far from exhaustive, but they just give a sense for the groups that may be disadvantaged by RAVs, and we suggest that further study is needed to identify such groups and to such that the inequities and unintended consequences can be mitigated. For example, in this particular case with the children and the adults, we could maybe for this portion above here to be able to compensate people for that. We could for example reference Stats SA earnings levels, which will be based on the likely qualifications that someone would have achieved, or we could reference the parents' income of the child, which is a good indication of what their income levels might have been. I will now hand over to Olata, who will touch on further broad design issues.
Good morning, Madam Chair and honorable members. I just want to check, is it possible to dim the lights on the projectors? I don't know if it's just my eyes, but they seem a bit faint. Can everyone see? Okay, perfect. In addition to the design issues that Nilan highlighted, I'm just going to look at two further broad design issues. The first of which is inflation protection. Now, the bill as it stands reads that the beneficiaries of RAVs are not guaranteed inflationary increases. but that the administrator may, from time to time, depending on affordability, allow for increases on those benefits. Now, this is important because a potential victim of a road accident would have lost certain salary increases, which we're going to look at now. Thank you for that. The chart you have on the screen there, we're contrasting price inflation, that's the red line, with income increases that would have been enjoyed by various groups. For instance, I've got the government employees in the green line. We've got minimum wages for domestic workers tracking the increases over the last 17 to 18 years, since about 2001. A bird's eye view of this, excepting a few swings round about there in the middle, 2009, generally the increases enjoyed by these various groups have been above price inflation. If you want to look at it numerically, I'm not sure if you can read those numbers, but essentially for all these groups, and we've included COID and Social Security for good measure, over the last couple of years, they've enjoyed increases in excess of price inflation. Now, we would respectfully submit or recommend that perhaps the benefit design be revisited to allow at least for price inflation increases, preferably a margin above that, say 1%. The next issue I want to look at, I just want to focus now on the proposed benefit formulae. Essentially, for the income support benefit, the formula is 75% of pre-accident income less Y, which is the post-accident income. Now, there are some limits on X there. For instance, X cannot be lower than the average annual national income and cannot exceed the prevailing RAF cap limit. However, there are further concerns that we have about the definition of X. X is pre-accident income. It's not clear in the draft whether additional fringe benefits such as bonuses, overtime, commission are included in that. And what of non-cash benefits such as the value of meals that a potential injured person was enjoying or living quarters? Additionally, there are pension benefits. Again, it's not very clearly defined whether those will be included in the X or not. And this is particularly important because the RAPS benefit ceases at age 60. The next key consideration is with respect to the 75%. Why 75%? It may be that perhaps this is related to the typical 75% that one sees on disability benefits, or it may be that that's the 75% that's used, for instance, for COIDA benefits. What's interesting, however, is that for COIDA, 75% is applied on gross income, income before tax. X, the pre-accident income as defined here, already takes into account tax. So to now allow for tax and over and above that allow for a further 75% deduction would seem to amount to double taxation. We would ask that this be re-looked at. Perhaps that 75%, since X is already accounted for tax, maybe that 75% should not be included at all. Another interesting result is illustrated in this example. Take someone who was earning 10,000 before the accident, and now for whatever reason, perhaps they can't work overtime. After the accident, they now only earn 8,000. So clearly, this someone has suffered a loss equal to 2,000. In the RAP system, X, or the pre-accident income, is reduced by 75%. So we would now take into account 7,500. The Y in the formula, the post-accident income, there's no factor applied on that. So it still remains 8,000. The net effect of all of this is that such a person will now not receive any compensation, even though they've clearly suffered a loss of 2,000. Now, it's not clear if this is just a formula misbehaving or this is the intended outcome. So is the intent to not compensate anyone who suffered a loss lower than 25%? If you now interrogate the why is the post-accident income? As we've said, there is no capping on the why. Perhaps a better way would be to apply the cap, to apply the cap on the loss as is currently being done on the RAF dispensation and not on the pre-accident incomes. Otherwise, a bulk of the population who've clearly suffered a loss will not receive any compensation at all. What's also interesting is that the way Y is defined, it includes passive income, and this would seem to penalize savers. For instance, it now offsets or mitigates your loss to the value of any savings that you have post-accident. Another interesting result is with respect to delayed losses. What if someone whose losses are not immediately apparent? Say someone was working and is still being compensated for now, but may have to retire earlier. So the actual loss that they'll suffer will only happen 20, 30 years into the future. How is REPS going to address this? I'm going to look at the family support benefit. I've not illustrated the formula, the various formulae, depending on whether there's just one spouse or multiple spouses, children or no children. We do, however, have some concerns regarding the FSB benefit formula. For instance, the formula seems a bit inflexible in that the deceased may have been supporting, for instance, his own parents and the surviving spouse not. The formula seems to assume that the dependents between the two, husband and wife, for instance, are the same. The formula for children only takes into account the income of the deceased and not of the surviving spouse. Now, we've run some numbers on this. There are instances where, in the current REF dispensation, both the surviving spouse and the children would not have a claim because the surviving spouse earns adequately to support herself and the children. However, in the way the formula is defined now, you get a case which potentially smacks of unjustified enrichment in that the children will now have a loss regardless. As I've said, we're only taking into account the deceased income. So is this intentional? The other issue concerns the dependency of the children. It currently ceases at age 18. It's not clear how disabled children who would have been supported for the remainder of their lives will be catered for in the new dispensation. It's also not clear whether foster children will be entitled to a claim if a foster parent dies. We would recommend that damages actuaries who work with on these cases on a daily basis and are familiar with the different permutations that could arise be approached, be engaged to provide some advice, or perhaps the formulae be tested, be run a number of times on various multiple cases. I will now hand over to Vim. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Alata. So we covered now a couple of the design topics. I'd like to move on now to the predicted cost of REPS, how one would determine that, and also the natural question is how would the cost, predicted cost of REPS, how does that compare to REF? The key point, one of the key points that I would like to make is that one needs to be careful when comparing the one system with the other system. A, because there are many differences inherent in the various systems, but also with the large degree of variability that is associated with RAVs, or at this stage at least with the potential introduction of RAVs. If you look at, for instance, consider the RAV system, it's been running for a number of years, we've got sufficient data, claims patterns, claims numbers, you know what the costs, administration costs, professional fees were. So that can be used to inform any projections that are done into the future. With RAVs, it's a bit different. Some of that data might be relevant, but a lot of the extra features that are being introduced, one either needs to make an educated guess or look at broader information, perhaps look at other countries where similar things have been implemented. But inherently, certain variations or uncertainty is being introduced into the system. So, for instance, if one looks at the slide there, there's a couple of variables, not exhaustive, not all-inclusive, but a few that I've listed on there, more or less as I've classified them in terms of what I feel might be the degrees of uncertainty associated with them. But it's debatable. It's view the slide more as illustrative rather than a scientific study that has been performed. But in essence, the concept that I want to bring across is that if you look at the left-hand side where the funnel is at its narrowest, say for instance something like funeral costs, moving from RAV to RAVs, it's probably fairly predictable. The number of claims might be very similar. The level of the benefit might not be exactly the same, but it should be fairly easy to predict what it would involve from moving from the one system to the other. As one moves towards the right-hand side, one introduces more uncertainty or certain unknowns or facts that are issues that are not yet clearly established. For instance, something like the medical tariffs, that still needs to be set. The actual rates need to be established. Public suppliers need to be involved in the system. So a certain amount of a degree of assumptions are required regarding that. Similar with medical expenses. Under the RAV system, there will be more medical claims. There will probably be higher take-up of medical services. Under the current system, a lot of the undertakings are not necessarily always taken up because a person that has got a merit apportionment applying against them might not be able to pay in their share, say the 20% that they were at fault for. So the question really is, but how much will the medical expenses go up by? And an assumption is required. Similar for administration costs, you'll have many more claimants under RAVs. All of them will remain on the system getting monthly payments. So if in the first year there might be 10,000 beneficiaries, and the next year there's 10,000 more coming in, and the third year more, and eventually it will stabilize at a fairly large number of beneficiaries all getting monthly payments. So the question really is, will administration costs be more similar? It's a risk factor that's being introduced into the system. The big one is also the introduction of no fault. It'll introduce many more claims into the system. Nealon pointed to the moral hazard that might be incorporated through that. As Nealon also said, what statistics might apply for South Africa in that regard? As far as we know, there are no other countries where a similar unemployment rate applies where this type of system was introduced. On the support benefit, the rehabilitation that will apply to the system, protocols, I'm not aware that has been set down yet. Also with rehabilitation, the big question is up to what point do you apply or do you try and rehabilitate a person? Up to what point does it become clear that that person will no longer be able to work and rehabilitation might not be necessary? Those are big questions that require assumptions to be made with either data that is not exactly suitable or possibly not even known. So the key thing is really that once one compares RAF with RAVs, the natural thing is to look at a number and say, well, the one is projected to cost X, the other one's projected to cost Z. But with RAVs, the key thing to remember is that there's a lot more inherent variability that is associated with that number. So if you look on the slide there, the dots might be the predicted cost, but with RAF, there's a lot more less probable less margin of error than with RABS. Because of all these issues that are being introduced, and also they are subject to, we'll put it this way, over time, as more data is obtained for those factors, the prediction could be done better. But at this stage, there's a lot more inherent volatility or variability that must be, decision makers must be cognizant of before comparing the two. So on that theme also, a recommendation or a consideration from our side is to consider a proper peer review of any actuarial work or designs or and so forth that has been done. The benefit of that is just to confirm that anything that is has been postulated or has been proposed is in line with alignment with objectives, that some of the assumptions that have been made are reasonable, that they can be justified, or identify those variables or assumptions that are of key importance. Peer review is a generally accepted business practice, and we would argue it's part of good governance and probably a logical step to take before introducing something of such critical importance to the country. If we move on, also on the cost side, we would argue that to compare RABS with RAF, it's already a difficult comparison because of no fault being introduced, rehabilitation being introduced. But specifically when it comes to general damages, it's quite obvious that the one system includes it, the other system does not include it. So it doesn't make sense to compare the two where general damages is included on the one side, a specific component benefit is included, but not on the other side. We would argue that a comparison that does on a like-for-like basis would either include general damages on both sides or exclude it. We don't have a view whether general damages is a constitutional right or not. That's not for the actuaries to decide. But from a logical perspective, we would just like to emphasize that a like-for-like comparison would do it on a general damages neutral basis. So the first slide there, for instance, looks at the current system or current RAF and the proposed RAFs. And we understand this slide has been presented to the committee. So there's a projected 33 cents per litre saving on RAFs. However, if one were to include general damages on both sides, the savings actually shifts to the RAF side, 13.3 cents per litre. So that now is if general damages were to be included on the RAF side. For instance, if that is deemed constitutionally, it's deemed constitutionally invalid to remove general damages, it has to be brought in under the RAF side. Or conversely, if it can be removed under RAFs, it could also be removed under RAF. And a like-for-like comparison would look like the slide that is there in front of you. Again, it's the savings actually shifts to the RAF side. So the important point really is just be clear that a like-for-like comparison is made when doing these comparisons. Lastly, I would just like to add a few comments on managing the various risks that are introduced or potentially introduced when moving over to a RABS type system. As I've noted, there are a couple of unknowns, a couple of uncertainties. All of these add to risk being introduced or potential risk. The more changes, the more variables, the more the risk. Particularly if all of that is implemented simultaneously at the same time, moving from a clean cut, moving from RAF over to RAFs. From a risk perspective, if you think about all the implementation risks, all the legal risks, all the operational, all the financial risks that are being faced, from a risk management perspective, it might be better to look at a modular or a stage-wise introduction of some of these proposals. So, for instance, I've got a image there showing a typical implementation cycle where one could, for instance, take, say, the no-fault principle, introduce it at a low level for certain accidents, and run that system for a while, whether that's a year or 2 years, whatever is sufficient to get reasonable information, reasonable patterns to emerge from that information. So that means one monitors the experience, and then after you've got sufficient feedback, move over to more changes or adjusting those factors that you have changed. So instead of a wholesale change, do a phase-wise, step-for-step introduction of these various risk factors. In that way, one can move from a RAF system to a RAF system, or whatever system in between is deemed suitable. It also means that many of these features of RAFs can actually be introduced under RAF. I've touched on the general damages one. Capping, for instance, capping, as Olata pointed out, is a much more significant feature of the RAF system. But there's no reason that can't be implemented under the RAF system. If it's possible under the one, it's also possible under the other one. Which could actually result in fairly quickly and immediate savings under the current dispensation, because you don't have to wait to implement RAFs. There might be a 2 or 3 year delay to get to that point, whereas one could phase by phase quickly look at implementing some changes to the current system. So that is covered basically in broad terms a few of the items that we wanted to highlight. We've looked at a few design issues, the moral hazard issue, the formula and so forth. I've touched on costing. I think the main theme is that we feel that there's still some work to be done. There's some investigations that need to be done, aspects that need to be clarified. A lot of the detail, when you look at the application of the formula, we're not sure that the one-size-fits-all will work that well, given the vast number of claimants with different circumstances. And then, as I said, risk management, that's key. There might be better ways to save costs to implement a number of the suggestions. Ultimately, we would welcome the opportunity to be engaged and assist in this further. So thank you for your attention. We would be happy to field any questions or suggestions.
Thank you very much, honorable members. There we are, very in-depth and insightful. Are the takers, honorable Ramatlakana, going? Honorable De Freitas, gone.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and thank you very much, Mr. Sotlutz, but quite a comprehensive presentation. Just a few questions. During the process of the department engagement with various stakeholders, in the year preceding the draft bill, did you engage with the department or commented at least on the general call they made around the intention, the views to move away from RAF to RAPS to the new system? Did you have that opportunity to comment? And if you have commented, given that we now have the bill on the table, are you still, you're saying you're still not happy with the, whether it is the X variables or Y variables in terms of going forward, and therefore the best way is to maintain the status quo while you're testing some, for an example, you talk about no fault on both sides. So that's the first question, really. I just want to understand from your side.
So my recollection is that around about 2014, the Department of Transport called for comments on the Road Accident Fund Bill. The Actuarial Society did submit comments at that stage, as I think did many other entities. Broadly covering more or less what we've discussed today, but when the revised bill came out, practically no suggestions or of our concerns were addressed in the revised bill. So hence we were actually welcoming this opportunity to be heard, because it didn't seem like there was a lot of comments that were made in the previous round that was actually transferred over into the bill, or at least if for instance one takes Olata's comment, we have a question about the formula, the 75%. Now, if the answer is, but that is truly what is intended, and it is understood that there are certain members or the beneficiaries that will be affected by that, but that is the intention, then that discussion ends. You know, it's not something we just want to highlight some of the issues and possibly get a response or feel for the thought process that went into designing some of these aspects.
No, thank you, Chair. Excuse me, I got the flu. So, Mr. Lutz, you would appreciate that that's a skill that you have in terms of actuarial skills. It's not what we have. We have to make law, and then the calculation has to happen somewhere else. In terms of we're dealing with the bill, and of course the bill is then supported by calculations at a later stage. I just want to understand the essence of your presentation. You therefore suggest that because you there's a lot of detail, but you're not explicit. When you talk about you're saying we need to pilot and look at this thing, whether it's going to work or not. That, for me, suggests that you don't quite agree that we should move from RAF to RAPS bill, given that you are talking about uncertainty of what the future holds. Am I understanding you correctly?
I think the point that I would like to make is that there's a lot of unpredictability and risk involved in moving over wholesale once off, which can be avoided. And I'm not sure whether that has been considered. The features of RABS, there are a few features that are unique, but there are many features that are not unique to RABS that could also be implemented under RAF. Or be brought into the current dispensation an equivalent can be introduced, whether it's similar capping or similar minimums, similar types of no fault arrangements and so forth. So what I'm saying is that there's a risk in introducing many features simultaneously as a dual system. There might be better opportunities to manage all of these, get proper information, and manage the risk or mitigate the risk properly.
Yes. Can I just maybe paraphrase that question? So, given this, what you're suggesting, would you think that the best way to go about the new act that we are busy with would be to have a phased approach in the implementation of it? In other words, do you think that we should, if we have this act or the bill that we have that we're now moving towards the act, we should structure it in a sense that it has in it almost like transitional provisions that you put in place while you are learning going forward in terms, in other words, phased up implementation of the bill, of the act. Is that what you envisage? Because you certainly can't run two acts at the same time. You either have to stick with the old or move to the new and build in the new the features that includes the kind of transitional or phased sectional space approach in terms of the implementation. That's the, really what I just want to understand from you.
At the moment, the proposal is that the two systems will run off or run parallel for a while the existing system, while the RAF system is in runoff, which I think is estimated to be maybe 8 years or so. So I'm not sure I understand the question. There will be the two systems, at least on the current proposals. What I'm saying is that there may be better ways to take the current system, apply some of the capping or some of the minimums, introduce some fault in the current system, whether that's on a limited basis or for certain accidents. That way you'll also eliminate the dual running of two systems and the double fuel levy that will be present for at least 6, 7, 8 years. Bring some of the existing features into the current system. You know, if you take the RAB system, let's suppose that there will be legal challenges on the way that the capping is done. Some people might argue that's unconstitutional because, let's say, 20% of people may no longer get a benefit from the RAB system. Other people might argue, but general damages is a right. You can't remove that from the system. So all of those issues will have to be dealt with at some point. And it could be a big challenge to introduce no fault, remove general damages, increase the capping, do all of that at the same time. You might find yourself delayed in litigation. You might find yourself it takes long to get all the rehabilitation centers established, all of the administration systems, staff training. So now you're talking maybe two years, 3 years, best case scenario, where RAVs might be up and running. If that, it might be much longer. Why not try and implement savings fairly quickly? So, for instance, take the general damages suggestion. That is a constitutional challenge that probably needs to be faced. That can be looked at in isolation, because if general damages can be removed under RAVs, it can, in theory, also be removed under RAV, under the current system, with an immediate saving of, I think, more or less 25%. And that then zooms in on one of the phases, one of the variables that can be looked at. That's just an example. You can do that for many of the other issues, like the capping, like the no fault.
Honourable. Yeah. Oh, Honourable Ramachakan, you are left with 90 seconds.
This will not share that quickly. Salutes, in terms of your presentation, you did, of course, appreciate the Judge Sedgwell Commission's recommendations in their last recommendations when they recommended that the RAFs should somehow be linked to the social security of the country. Now, in your calculation, when you take issue with whether 60 years of age, don't you think that you are not considering, your presentation is not even considering what those 8 recommendations that were made by the Judge Sedgwell in terms of the going forward of the new order scheme? And of course, because if you were to look at that, and if we were to get another different view, or if we were to employ the experience of the actuary in Parliament and give them this recommendation, surely they will come to a different conclusion. Or is your view that what you've presented, taking into account the Commission recommendations, is like a Bible? what you have presented now today?
I think when we represent the actuarial society, so the key thing for us is to point out potential unintended consequences that might be put on the table. So if a recommendation is made and it's made from a legal standpoint or from a national social welfare standpoint, and there are no consequences from a financial point of view, that we would not point out that there might be potential issues. We are merely saying that what is being put on the table has inherent risks that are being introduced from an actuarial point of view, and the decision makers must be aware of that. If this type of product were to be introduced by a private insurance company, they would never do that because of the potential for selection against that company, or alternatively put in measures in place or tweak the benefits in ways that risk is mitigated. So we are merely calling for a consideration of the inherent risks that might be unintended based on those recommendations.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks to the presenters for the presentation. Just some quick questions. Just a few questions. So from your assessment, you would say that really it's the poor that would be potentially worse off under the scheme as it is tabled. I just wanted to confirm that. And then secondly is that you talk about a double taxation. I could ask you to unpack that a little bit more for us when you say that. And then I find it interesting you said that your comments previously when you submitted in a few years back when this bill was being designed were pretty much being ignored. Were there any of your comments that you submitted previously incorporated into the RABS as it is at the moment? And then when you talk about a transitional phase or phasing in of different aspects of this bill, I would presume it wouldn't just be phasing in for the sake of phasing in, but it would include monitoring and evaluation and seeing where that particular phase needs to or should be improved or changed or amended so that the best product in the end comes out. If you could just confirm that's the case and maybe just unpack that a little bit more. Thank you.
Okay, I think the first two questions I'm going to defer to Nilan. It was the question about the subgroups or the poor as a group and then the double taxation. I'll take the comment about the question about previous comments and the phased approach.
Thank you, Chair. Regarding the impact on the poor, it is a mixed bag, is what we're saying, and that it needs to be explored to see the extent of which groups in the poorer communities will suffer and which will benefit. So it's not a clear cut one way. It is definitely better or definitely worse for the poor. Yeah. Regarding the double taxation, again, we're not sure what the intention was of applying the 75% to the pre-accident income. If it is an allowance for taxation, then it would be a double taxation because it is being applied to net income. But it hasn't been explained. We haven't seen any justification or reasoning for it. We're not sure, but we're just pointing that out. Thanks.
Okay, so coming back to the previous round of comments, I'll have to go back and look at all our detailed comments and whether any of them were incorporated. If they were, it was fairly minor in essence. I would say there were five or six big themes as we've covered today. I don't think they were at all considered. Perhaps some of the minor definitions might have changed in result, as a result of our commentary. On the phased approach, absolutely. Such a phased approach, as I had on the slide, that comes with proper monitoring, adjustment, and then subsequent decisions based on your current or your experience over the period.
Honorable Defenders, can we agree that you will be able to submit the request of the infusion of some of your things within, say, 48 hours? Will that be fine with you? If you go back and check what have been put into the current bill, and you are able to come back to us within 48 hours so that Honorable Member can be able to have an understanding.
We can do that.
Honorable Defaitas, you fine? Okay. Honorable Sibande?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll also like to thank the presenters about their presentation. But nevertheless, only few clarity. Chairperson, I think the intention of the bill, of the RAFS bill, was also to deal about the issue of transformation. Because some of the laws were formulated before you were born, and even myself, I was born in 1942. And I can go on and on the sequences of this. And then also, beside transformation, is to deal about compliance. May you please help us about the things which you feel they are unconstitutional. Because to me, some of the things you raise, like in his presentation, was dealing about the family benefits, about bonuses, overtime, and pension benefits, that falls under labor. To me, that falls under labor. We're not dealing with labor here. We're dealing with RAFS bill under transport. But the presenters were dealing with labor issues. And also, you were dealing with social service issues. But that's why I'm saying, may you please help us with things which are unconstitutional. And then you were dealing about the issue of comparison between the RAFS and the RAF. To me, if you talk about the issue of transformation and efficiency gains, I can say we have increased fraud reputation prior to payment, because a lot of cases were being pinned up before the payments. That is achievements in terms of the RAFS. And then also, in terms of the efficiency, you can talk about the... Do you still remember that we had a lot of bedlocks, payments which were not done? But since now we have significant increase in terms of the claims which have been paid. So what is your take in that regard? Just these few things. What is not constitutional? Because we are, you see, to just go around with things are constitutional, that is something else. If they are unconstitutional, then that's something very serious. What is unconstitutional, which you have identified? Because you were able to identify the comparisons. Thank you, Jefferson.
It's an unfortunate question that I can't give you a definite answer because I'm not a constitutional expert. We are here as actuaries that look at benefit design issues, at costing issues. So I can give you a few ideas, but for me to say that they are definitely unconstitutional or not, That remains to be either tested in the courts or probably it's best commented on by the various legal societies that have been presenting. For instance, we've talked about general damages. Many would argue that is a constitutional right. Compensation for pain and suffering is something that everybody is entitled to. As the actual society, we don't have a view on that. We cannot have a view on that because that is not our area. But that is something that could potentially be a stumbling block. The capping that Ulata has referred to, so you could now have an individual that, because of the way that the capping formula applies, that individual will receive zero benefit under the RAB system. At the moment, if somebody in that category under the RAF system is in an accident, they will still get a benefit. It'll be a capped benefit, but they will still get something. Under the current or under the proposed system, that individual will no longer get any benefit. It remains to be seen exactly how many people that is. We've done some analysis, so I think under the current system, maybe 10% of cases are affected by the cap under RAF. But under RAFs, it might be 25%, 30%. I'm guessing here, but it could be way more significant. Now, if you consider that the common law right of a person to recover their damages against the actual wrongdoer is also eliminated, so the person will have no recourse, no benefit from RAFs, and no ability, a legal right to actually reclaim the damages from the drunk driver or whoever, even if that person is sufficiently able to compensate them. One could argue that is unconstitutional. It gets quite complex when one looks at the various formula laid out in the annexures or the schedules to the bill. But one in particular stood out for me when it comes to the family support benefit, particularly when the deceased had more than one wife. How it works currently is that the compensation is, as you mentioned, it's there are quite a few bills and pieces of legislation that were passed years ago. And when it comes to compensation for multiple spouses, there's a bill called the Black Laws Amendment Act, which I think dates back to 1963, which is quite discriminatory. The current formula in the RAPS bill is still based on that legislation, or it seems to be informed by that legislation. That doesn't look right to me. So, I mean, there are three examples for you. I don't want to put my head on a block and say that they are unconstitutional. It's not my field, but there's potential there for challenges.
Honorable Sibande, 2 minutes left.
Okay. Chairperson, I was talking about the issue of transformation. Actually, I was talking about the issue of transformation. That the intention of the bill is to deal about the issue of transformations. So, and then I've asked him that, what is your take in terms of transformation? Because some of these laws, as you are putting exactly about something of 1963, and most of these issues were created in 1942, and then there was an act of 1956, act number 56 of 1956, where they were trying to do some of the changes and also of commissions up until 1999, whereby they created the Road Accident Fund Commission, which was adopted 2011 also, which was referred to the cabinet. So let me come back with this one. In terms of the accountability, the intention of the bill also is to introduce the issue of compliance framework rather than the road tax and fine alone. So what is your take in that regard? Because it seems that, I was comparing with your comparisons. That's why I'm bringing this one, that to me, the RAFs also is very much in a little bit advanced in terms of the accounting. And then also, you see the reported outcomes in terms of on accountability enforcement. Remember, previous it was so quiet, but now recently we've discovered a lot of lawyers, firms, and doctors which were involved in a lot of it, atrocities. Because what is our intention? If I'll put an example, somewhere in your presentation, I even nearly laughed with this one. You said, you spoke about the RAFs. I wanted to go back on it as an example. You said it represents the poor. And you said RAFs, its intention is to represent. RAFs aim to provide benefits for the poorer section of the population. That's what you said. Exactly. Because most of the people, they think in advancements of enriching themselves in terms of the road tax and fund. Like the argument which we bring time and again, whereby people, they wanted to see themselves paid with dollars and the like. What about the poor people here? Because some of the lawyers, they don't want this money to be paid direct to the people. They want it to via them in the trust fund. At the end, people, the poorer people, they don't even benefit anything because it end up in the trust fund. So what is your take? Thank you, Chairperson.
Look, I think we fully agree with the strategic objective of transformation. I think in the first few slides I did mention that is also the actual society's objectives and one of our key strategies. I think when we spoke about RAFs benefiting the poor, we agree with that as a very broad statement. However, what we wanted to do was to point out that within the poor, what can be classified as a poor, the poor group or poor classification, there are various subgroups within that group that is not better off under the current system. So once again, as I pointed out, our stance is to point out unintended consequences and impacts to assist the policymakers to make better decisions. Because if the general statement is that the poor is better off, it may be true, but within the poor segment, children will not be better off. Individuals that are only covered up to age 60 are not better off. Many of the transformational aspects can be incorporated into the current system. As far as the practice is with attorneys, I'm unfortunately not the best person to comment on that. That must be asked of the law societies. Dylan, I'm not sure, would you want to add something?
Go ahead.
I'd just like to add that from our perspective, I guess one of the main concerns that we have is the cost impact. Because that's a lot of our work involves benefit design, the costing of the benefits, understanding the impact on all the various stakeholders. So the costing is a big concern for us in terms of the immediate wholesale movement from one to the other, one system to the other, with a lot of uncertainties, but also because of the running a dual system, which will have to be done, because RAF claims will take many years to run off, so that system can't be shut down for quite a long time, and introducing a whole new system to run alongside it for that period, it's basically the setup costs and the startup costs of introducing it that way. That's our main concern, and the And that's why we're proposing that what can be done to cut costs immediately, because we understand that cost is an issue. So what can be done to cut the costs immediately under the current system be implemented already, in line with proposals that are for RABS, and that if and when RABS is vetted, the movement from RAF to RABS will also be much more seamless and much quicker, because a lot of the stuff would have already been incorporated under RAF. But we're just indicating that we're not sure that the cost aspects have been considered as much as they should have. Thanks.
Is it possible that you can flag out the issues that you believe can be infused into the RAF from the RAPS bill? You
sure,
can.
Sure, yeah.
Thank you very much. Honorable Sithole.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the presenters. Chairperson, first thing that I want to understand, or other, is they can define, according to their understanding, the criminally negligent drivers can, because according to them, they say they can benefit. Now I want them to define the criminally negligent drivers, if they can define that one. And then the other one, Chairperson, if they can make us understand the benefit, because according to them, they say loss of earnings. RAF, comparison between RAF and RAPS, and RAPS, because they say, according to their understanding, the loss of earnings and the income support, and the loss of support and the family support benefit, medical costs and health care services, if they can actually unpack those, their understanding on this comparison that they made. And the other one, Chairperson, is that one of they provide for benefit in respect of income support, because according to them, they say the RAF provides for compensation in respect of loss of income, loss of support, medical costs, funeral expenses, and general damage. They are compensated, because according to RAPS, they say they provide a benefit in respect of the income support. If they can unpack all that one, thank you very much.
Lutz?
So the question about criminal negligence, look, just a few examples. An individual that is drunk on the road and is now in an accident will be able to claim. Somebody that hijacks a car, speeds away, and it speeds way exceeding the speed limit, will be able to claim. That is because of the no-fault system. So I think maybe some of those aspects can be looked at, and some exclusions can be put on the system in terms of what exactly will be covered and not. It's not 100% clear exactly what will be done with those cases. My understanding is that will result in valid claims, or could potentially. In terms of the comparison between the various types of benefits, so let's, for instance, say loss of earnings or loss of support versus income benefit or family support benefit, I think maybe just to make a general comment, the big difference really between the two systems at the moment is that under RAF, compensation is provided to put the person in the same position than one would expect them to have been had the accident not occurred. So for instance, if it's somebody that was young, there would be some consideration of any career progress that person could have made, and compensation would be based on that. If it's a spouse, if she was 30 years old, but she wasn't working and her husband passed away, she had an expectation of maybe another 30 or 35 years of support until the deceased passed away. And under the current compensation, one would calculate the loss based on that. So it's the common law principle of putting a person in the same position than they would have been had the accident not occurred, with the exception that there is the cap. So the cap could interfere with that, but that's relatively a small proportion of matters. Whereas under the current or the proposed RAB system, there's a set of formula that specifically defines what each individual will get, which is not necessarily related to the exact loss that they have suffered or will suffer. It's a specific rule or formula that just says, if you earn 5,000 Rand per month, we're going to multiply that by 75%, and we're going to deduct whatever you can earn, and whatever the answer is, that will be your compensation. There are various formulas. So, you know, there's an initial temporary benefit and then a long-term benefit. So it gets complicated to look at all those formulas. But as a general principle, whereas there's compensation for your lifetime expectation under the one system, there's a formula under the other system which might not necessarily tie back to the total expected loss.
Sitole, are you okay? Okay, thank you. Honorable Tlako.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. I also thank the delegation for its presentation. Chair, what I understand is that as lawmakers, amongst our responsibilities is to revisit the laws that we approve and come up with the best. That's why we appreciate what we have just brought in front of us. Because through these engagements, we will end up coming with the best law ever. But Chair, let me ask the few questions that I have just noted. I think generally what the team of actuaries is concerned with is the general damages, which they propose a no-fault cover. Do you think that can be the best solution if we can say yes to what we are proposing, the no-fault cover that we have just come up with? And also, Chair, there's a point that I take in their presentation when they want us to revisit the issue of dependence with regards to disabled children. Because in the bill, we're saying we will not go more than 18 years, forgetting that a disabled child is dependent on someone till death sometimes. So I think they have a point. I'm not saying we are agreeing, but I am noting that as an individual. On the issue of foster children, I think when one is fostering a child, if that child is dependent on you, someone is able to claim if he can prove that child that you have fostered was dependent on you. Do they want us to single out, put it in black and white in the bill that we must also include fostered children? On the issue of formulas, Chair, I think I'm just a layman around that, but I take the point. We will also refer some of whatever you have raised with our internal systems. We'll ask some of the, we'll refer some of your whatever concern that we have raised in our internal engagements with the department and RAF. I think generally you are raising the issue of general damages. Where are you putting the fact of when one loses life? Because in the Constitution, we must protect that. But there is a benefit that we call a death benefit around. What I'm saying about that is the amount that is proposed enough according to you, because I see it as a something that needs to be increased, the benefit when one loses, the funeral benefit. Generally, as members of the committee, we understand that in whatever change that we introduce, there will be reactions. Nonetheless, we thank your presentation for, because it will result in the best law that we can come up with as a committee. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay, thank you, Honourable Member. On the general damages issue, it's not something that we specifically raise or are proposing it should be removed or included and so forth. The point that I was trying to make is that to compare a cost, the cost of the one system with the cost of the other system, do that on a neutral basis, because it's not fair to compare the one where there's one benefit excluded and the other system where the benefit is not, it's included on the one side, it's excluded on the other side. So we're merely taking a cost perspective and say, well, that is a glaring difference. If the one is included on the one side, it's best to also include it on the other side. Then you can do a like an apple for apple comparison. So that was really the point there. There may be constitutional challenges which, as I said, we can't comment on. But if it's possible to take it away from the one system, it's also possible for the other system. Or conversely, if it has to be included on the one side, it also has to be included on the RAF side. And that has implications for the costs of the systems and making a decision whether the one is more expensive or cheaper than the other. At the moment, the picture isn't comparing like with like, and we'd like to caution against not doing that. The questions you raised about children, we fully support that. Disabled children, we would suggest that should be a separate category in the legislation that specifically protects those children. Even if you look at the wording for existing children, where the benefit is limited up to age 18, that could be argued as a fairly arbitrary cutoff. In theory, the argument might be, but that's when a child might be expected to matriculate. But many children turn 18 early in the year of their matric. So at least it should be the end of the calendar year in which the 18th birthday is reached. Even then, 18 might not be sufficient, because what we see often is that a child without matric is at a severe disadvantage in the labor market. So the aim should be to get all these beneficiaries at least to a point where they can matriculate. Possibly even guarantee tertiary studies or a period of tertiary studies. So to only allow for cover up to age 18 means that the individual that already failed 1 year, then the accident happens, there's no way that they would have been able to matriculate at age 18. It would have been at age 19 perhaps. Couple that with the fact that now a father or a mother passes away, that might be disruptive. That could be an extra year. So we just feel that a strict definition of 18 years might be a bit penal on a fairly vulnerable group, children in this case. Similarly, for foster children, that could be seen as defined as a separate category and specifically addressed in the bill to protect them. I don't know, can you remember further questions? I think there was a question about formula. I think there was a question about the death benefit and the formula, whether that's adequate. I wasn't sure whether that relates to the family support benefit or to general damages, because I don't think there's normally general damages payable on death.
Honorable Teko, would you want to rephrase the question again?
Yes, Chair, I think let me go back to where I mentioned the issue of 18 years and a child. I was specifically with disabled children only. I understand the issue of 18 years with normal children. I was specifically with the disabled. It's where I took your point. I said I'm taking your point with regards to disabled children. I was saying there's a benefit that a family gets when one has passed away in the current situation. And I think it is also there with the proposed bill. The issue, the death benefit, there's a death benefit that is there. Is it enough what is proposed or what is currently used as within the scheme or the fund?
Look, we as the actual society don't specifically have a view on that aspect. It's not really our field to comment on the sufficiency. I think as long as the cover is at least what you get under the rest system, you know that. But it probably needs to be looked at and aligned. That's really the if I have to add any comment to that aspect.
Honorable Shelembe.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question relates to the issue of the overtime payment. As far as I know, the person is entitled to overtime payment because of the work performed outside the normal working hours. Now, it happens, say, like maybe says either an office or factory where the overtime is caused by one employee not at work, maybe the shift or something like. And in some other cases, is caused by there are delayed maybe orders in the factory, you know, saying now you need now people to do, those overtime. Now, say the person is working for that factory and that factory has been getting big orders, to push out. Say that person now, after that accident, that factory now is no longer, having big orders to send out, which the more orders that we have, it contributes a lot to the economy of the country. Now, in that case where that company is no longer having big orders, but why do you say that person must continue for long getting or entitled to have the overtime when you consider that? So I'm not getting well. Why? Because as I'm saying, I believe you are entitled to an overtime because you have worked for it. But when you get employed, you are given, a contract to say you will be working, say, 40 hours a week. That is not, nobody can argue that. But in the case now where this is now, only if there is something to be done urgently, how do you determine now, say, that company that has been contributing a lot to the economy of the country because of having big orders, that it will continue having the big orders after the accident?
Thank you, Mr. Shalembe, for that question. In our experience, having looked at thousands of payslips, the overtime varies by company, as you correctly point out. There are some individuals where overtime is a significant component of their salary. It could be like anything between 50% and 80% of their income. There are also cases where overtime is rare and occasional. As an interesting contrast, the COID specifically addresses the issue of seasonality of overtime. If overtime, for instance, is regular, that is included in the income component of their calculation. If it's a rare, something that happens, if, for instance, once in a while when there are big orders that you mentioned, it's not to be included. I think what we were addressing or what we were arguing is that in the current definition of that, they call it X, that person income, it's not clear whether overtime is included there or not. So we would, I mean, it seems logical that if a big portion of your income is overtime earnings and is fairly regular, we would think that that should be included as part of your compensation, or your compensation should be based on that. So it's really just about defining X. What does it include? What does it not include? We understand, obviously, that, I mean, there are no clear-cut rules whether, okay, this is what we mean by regular, this is what we mean by occasional overtime. But it's just something that's worth looking into, and maybe it could be worded a bit better in the current legislation. I don't know if you might want to add something on that.
Yeah, I'd perhaps just maybe give an example. So let's suppose you have a person that's injured in an accident. They work in a factory environment where we've got payslips for that individual for a 12-month or a 24-month period, and it's quite clear that that person regularly works overtime. Maybe they earn a basic salary of 5,000 Rand a month, plus overtime equating to maybe 2,000 Rand per month, so a total of 7,000 Rand per month in total earnings. So what you often see is when an individual is in an accident, they may recuperate for 3 months or so and then go back to the employer. The employer finds that this person is no longer able to stand as long on their feet or to be as physically active, but the employer would then say, okay, I'm going to accommodate you in a different position. You can no longer work in the factory, but let's put you in an admin position. But that admin position no longer comes with the associated ability to work overtime. So we're still going to pay you 5,000, but now you just have a normal 9-to-5. There's no possibility of overtime. And we are saying that is a loss. Many of the cases that we deal with on a day-to-day basis is of that structure, where a person is now accommodated and no longer can work the same level of overtime, which constitutes a loss for them.
Yes, Jim, just checking. Don't you think it is wise that the issue of the overtime is not determined by the Transport Portfolio Committee? The reason being, we are dealing with the issues of the accident and the compensation. Now, the issue of overtime, that's my personal feeling, is not something that must be determined by the Portfolio Committee on Transport, but that matter must be discussed at maybe the labor, because it related now to the issue now of the working hours, overtime, this and that. But in our case here, is the issue of how do we assist in the accident. Now, it's very difficult now to determine the long run of the company outside that it will continue having the overtime in that company. Don't you think it is wise that let this committee be not involved in the issue of those overtime and this and that in a business where we do not have much say as the Portfolio Committee on Transport?
You must remember the bill as it stands has got certain formula and definitions in that bill. It's contained in that bill. We are calling for expansion of those definitions, clarification of those definitions. So whether it's within this committee that those discussions take place or whether it's a labor discussion, as long, and this is the important thing, as long as it then informs those definitions and formula, because if those formula gets applied without this issue being resolved, members or beneficiaries are going to be affected. So those formula that's really where the essence lies. That's where the benefit that members or beneficiaries will get, that's where it's going to be determined, based on those formula and based on those definitions. And if those definitions are either incomplete or have inherent in them unintended consequences, that's going to be translated directly to the compensation individuals get. So the discussion needs to be had, and that needs to filter up to the definitions and the formula.
Thank you very much. Maybe if we are to cap double taxation, as you indicated earlier on, what is it that we can be able to put in the bill which will assist us to avoid double taxation using RAF and RAPS at the same time? I know that he earlier on indicated that there can be other things that we can be able to factor into the RAF bill, into the RAF Act as it currently is from the bill itself. But I just want us maybe to say double taxation, these are the things that can be put in place. You may not necessarily be having those now, but you can also submit that in writing. You also indicated that there's we need to revisit the benefit design, the benefit scheme design. What are the things that we should look into if we revisit the benefit scheme design, which actually you believe does not need to be factored into the bill? Thanks.
Thank you.
You can respond.
The double taxation, Olato, was that in your part? Maybe you can cover that.
Yeah, I think, thank you for the question. I think what we were arguing was that it's not clear what that 75% is intended to address. If we are reducing the pre-accident income by 75% to allow for the fact that the benefits are tax-free, because the formula already uses net income, it already uses income after tax in the way that X is defined, to then apply a further 75% reduction on that, if and only if the intention was to allow for the impact of tax, then that would be, that would amount to double taxation. Now, as a measure to ameliorate that, perhaps then the pre-accident income to be used could be a gross figure, a before tax figure. Another alternative would be just take out that 75% altogether. So the various other ways, but this is seriously contingent on whether the intention of that 75% was to address the tax issue. And that's why we compared it with the COIDA. COIDA applies 75 on gross income, and in the proposed bill, we're applying 75 on net income. So yeah, so there are options that one could look into. Thank you.
If maybe we can just do it in an exemplary form, that the beneficiary is supposed to be receiving, say, an amount of 300,000. Does it mean that we will have to take the 75% of the 300,000, or firstly you will have to tax the 300,000 and then take 75%, give it to this person, or what exactly is happening?
Thank you for that question. It's the latter option that you've indicated. The way it's defined now, you would take the 300,000, deduct tax on that, and then further and above that, still apply a 75% reduction. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, it's clear now. Can revisit in terms of the design of this scheme.
Nelly, do you want to take that? Because it's more or less with in line with the, some of the... I think maybe just before we start, we've only highlighted a few, so we're bound to forget many, but I think you can touch on a few.
Okay, thank you for the question. The benefit design, as Wim's just pointed out, there are It needs to be, you know, benefit design is something that actually that's what we do a lot of, and it always needs to be looked at holistically. What are we trying to achieve for which stakeholders? What is, you know, in terms of if we change this benefit, then these stakeholders suffer, but then we're able to introduce a benefit for other stakeholders who we want to rather focus on, all those kinds of things. So it's difficult to say it must only be these benefits that must be looked at. It must always be looked at as a whole, but in particular the ones that we've pointed out today in the benefit design and features that we also feel could be introduced under the current system with immediate cost savings, as opposed to running a dual system, incurring dual costs and waiting for a longer period to introduce these changes. Some of the benefit designs is, for example, the general damages, the capping of the benefits under the RAF system. The cap could be increased or reduced so that there's lower claims. Is, for example, that benefit change in benefit would immediately affect higher income earners and not affect the low income earners at all, and immediately introduce cost savings. So there's all these kinds of benefit design. I mean, what we are saying is we're not sure what the time pressures are and the capacity you have to engage with us, the Actuarial Society. But we if we are given more information, if we can have more information on the objectives of the changes in benefits, we could advise as to how to achieve them without prejudicing the stakeholders unintentionally. You know, for example, children or young widows, those kinds of things. I'm not sure if that helped.
Yeah. Thank you very much. We really appreciate your insightful presentation, and we would expect from you, we have given you some further assignments which will be brought back to the portfolio committee. You are recused, so that we can be able to have the Risk House Africa Actuaries will be the next presenters if they are around. Oh, Honorable Ramatlakana, before you leave the stage.
No, thank you, Chair. If Mr. Lewis can be of assistance to the committee, in one of the presentations he spoke about almost like a two-tier payment system. You talked about one should be used in terms of the social welfare earnings if it's unemployment, and others could then be a protocol that could be worked out that takes into account moral hazard. I think that's the word to use. Maybe not today, if they could submit I'm interested to see how that could be factored into a legislation. If you say moral hazard will take care of the high earnings, because you then have to look at them individually, if you can just write something down that we can consider in a formulation of this, because maybe if you could help us with that.
Thank you.
That does not need an answer. It's a further assignment that you're giving for you to can be able to come back, and then you'll be given marks in that regard. You are recused. Risk House, are you around? Okay. Okay. If you can just 3 minutes comfort break while he's setting up.
Yeah.
Thank you, honorable members. Can we resume? Welcome, this house, Mr. I'm trying to. Okay.
Mr. Haribai. Mr. Haribai.
Haribai. Yeah, I wanted to. To be sure that I'm pronouncing your surname properly, Mr. Haribai, you're heartily welcome. We are continuing, this is a continuation, and probably it will go to the provinces for us to can be able to say that this bill really has what it takes. We dealt with the lawyers last week, now we're dealing with actuaries. Actuarial societies, and our anticipation is that you will be able to guide us so that we're able to have and make decisions and amendments from an informed position. The portfolio committee has given you a 30 minutes for the presentation, and then another 30, 40 minutes will be given to honorable members to engage you with your presentation, and then we will be able to take it up from there. But part of the things that we sometimes don't do, is to give you further, whether it's an assignment or a homework, for you to go and do on our behalf and come back to us so that we can be able to look at it as to issues that have been raised and for further assessment with from you. And that's how we do it. I'll be introducing honorable members as they will be asking you questions. You can make your presentation. You're welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, honorable members of the Portfolio Committee on Transport and other members of the National Assembly. Good morning to the Chair. Thank you for this opportunity to present the feedback we've provided on the RAPS bill previously via written presentation to the committee. This presentation outlines that feedback in a more detailed and a more illustrative manner. I will begin with an overall slide which gives us an overview of what we'll be discussing as part of the feedback. It follows the same sort of structure that you may have seen previously in the actual society with some differences. As an overall objective, my objective today is to highlight some of the technical actuarial issues, but also highlight some of the issues from a conceptual point of view, using an actuarial mindset, and therefore pose it to you for any questions. As background, the updated bill, or the RAPS bill, seeks to provide for a social security scheme for the victims of road accidents, to establish the Road Accident Fund Benefit Administrator to administer and implement the scheme, to provide a set of defined benefits on a no-fault basis to persons for bodily injury or death caused by or arising from road accidents, to exclude liability of certain persons otherwise liable for damages in terms of the common law, and to provide for matters connected therewith. This is just an overview for everybody to reposition what we are here for today. In terms of specific areas that we would like to provide an oral presentation on, the first item is financial viability. RAPS is intended to replace the current fault-based system, which often results in extensive and costly litigation, prolonged claims finalization, and high administrative costs. The current dispensation for liability upon proving that the road accident was caused by the fault of the driver of another vehicle. Under RAPS, fault on the part of the claimant or any other person involved in the accident will not be considered. Therefore, it is a no-fault-based system. Part of this change also includes moving from a lump sum payment basis to a periodic or payment-structured benefit basis. The first issue that we would like to highlight is the issue of lump sum payments versus periodic payments. I would just like to state that this is just to highlight the potential issues. The ultimate decision is obviously up to the policymakers. If we look at the comparison to insurance operations locally and internationally, it can reveal some potential issues with the new system. An insurer's cost to manage periodical payment awards will in general be far greater than those to manage a lump sum payment. And this is for the following reasons. There are extensive and complex systems required to make these payments and manage them. There are underlying systems required to manage claimants' addresses and contact details. And furthermore, there are systems required to monitor any changes in the claimant's medical conditions and even ensure that the claimant is still alive. The systems and administration required for each of these areas should not be underestimated. The result of this is that the lost expenses, which are the expenses required to manage claims, will be far greater if compensation is paid via periodical payments than if paid via a lump sum. So one of the pillars of assessing the financial viability of the RAPS bill could therefore be based on the balance between the projected saving of reduced litigation costs versus the increased costs of administration. This is one factor that should be considered. Taking a bird's eye view or overall view, we are recommending a hybrid solution of the current RAF legislation and the proposed RAPS bill. So in order to provide a balance between the potential increase in claims and claims costs in administration, it is advisable that no fault cover at first be introduced at low levels, perhaps similar to that of current disability benefits. However, in the event that fault can be proved on the counterparty, then a claim may be made for increased compensation from the RAPS bill or directly from the other counterparty, if over current cap levels. And this may introduce a sort of a national need for third-party cover from individuals themselves, thereby reducing the burden on the state. Further compensation, if it's deemed to be appropriate, could be recommended based on a specific protocol of claims underwriting, which could then be formally assessed by claims assessors on a case-by-case basis with a singular panel of experts. And I've highlighted singular panel of experts because part of the reason of the high costs of the RAF legislation and of the entire system is because you always have two sides to every claim. You have the plaintiff side, which is the lawyers, and then you have the fund itself, which is defending that. And that is an incredibly expensive setup to have for each and every claim. So what we are suggesting here as well is that certain aspects should be made singular versus the dual aspect that you currently have. So I just want to highlight a simple example in terms of where you could have a singular panel versus where you would still require a dual panel. So for example, the industrial psychologists that are usually used in each of the matters make an assessment, a subjective assessment on the impact of the accident on the individual. That impact is assessed based on their history, their family history, and their potential career progression. This is a subjective assessment, and you will always require a dual panel, so to speak. So you will always require somebody proposing something and somebody defending something. On the other hand, you could have a singular panel of actuaries. Actuaries work on instruction. We work directly based on the recommendations of the industrial psychologists, occupational psychologists, and educational psychologists. We do not apply extensive judgment. We take their progression, their project progression, and we apply that directly in estimating the cost of the claim. Therefore, in the new system, you could have a singular panel of actuaries always. Looking forward to the aspect of moral hazard or anti-selection, this relates to the issue of a no-fault system. A major unknown is the effect of no-fault on the number of claims. Because if you do not require fault to be proved or disproved, you will necessarily have an increase in the number of claims because people do not feel that they have something to prove. So you will have a significant increase in the number of claims. This is a particular issue in South Africa because we have a very, very high unemployment rate, and therefore you will have the propensity for more people to claim as a result of being injured or claiming that they are injured. An unemployed person may attempt to elicit a no-fault-based compensation for loss. This is a significant fraud risk and will work against the overall objective of social security by potentially encouraging more people to stage and or deliberately cause injury and deaths due to road accidents. If we compare to the COIDA system, it is also provided on a no-fault basis, but claimants have to be employed in order to participate in the benefit structure. The risk, therefore, is much lower because you have to be within a certain system and meet certain rule requirements. Solvency management. I think an important aspect of moving from the old to the new system or whatever interim system may be introduced is that it is very important to keep a finger on the pulse, so to speak, on the solvency management of the scheme, and therefore regular reviews in terms of annuitizing the costs of the claims need to be compared to the overall funding of the scheme. Retirement funding. This is a fairly new aspect that we would like to recommend as part of the changes in legislation. Working with these matters on a day-to-day basis, what we do not see enough of is a need or a requirement to set aside part of the claim or the compensation for retirement purposes. All matters that are assessed for road accident fund compensation only look at the point up until retirement. But what is not considered is that beyond retirement, there is no compensation being provided, and therefore some mechanism needs to be established to mandate or require people to set aside part of that income or compensation for their retirement benefit. There is, of course, the state benefits for retirement, but as we all know, that will not be sufficient in most cases. And also, I'm not sure if the committee is aware, in general, we are faced as a population with something called a longevity crisis, so to speak. People are living longer and longer, and therefore, you need to provide for that for a longer period of time. It's not necessarily a negative, but if it's not provided for, it can be a crisis. This links back to the original slide, which talked about a hybrid solution, which would be a no-fault system at certain levels, and thereafter the normal system where you have to prove fault. That could also be introduced for special cases, so we would recommend that for these special cases, you would still require the normal approach where the case needs to be brought towards the fund and the case needs to be argued in order to get the best possible compensation for the claimants. This has also been informed by analyzing the current benefit structure that's being proposed, and we have found that these particular individuals, may be negatively impacted in terms of compensation. So that would include individuals who have suffered brain injuries, children under the age of 18, students under the age of 21, and young workers at the start of their careers or under the age of 27. The reason the last three sort of categories have been brought forward is similar to the issues that Actual Society have raised. The last two items have been brought because the RAPS bill recommends an average national income, and this average national income does not appropriately take into account young workers at the start of their careers who do not have a history of income that can be relied upon. Looking at the average annual national income itself as an issue, for individuals who earn less than the value of the average national income, which is currently being proposed, there is a strong incentive for these claimants not to disclose or attempt to not disclose this actual income. The current average national income is large relative to the current incomes of many RAF claimants. Therefore, you could have a scenario where people avoid disclosing their income and therefore by default would be entitled to the average national income, and this would act to increase your claims cost. And the issue you're faced with is that you have a compounding effect of increased claims costs as well as administrative costs under the new scheme. And in its current state, it's unclear how the bill plans to address this issue. That brings us largely to the end of my oral presentation. So I suppose the key questions that we'd like to propose as recommendations is how does RAPS fit into a wider social security objective that we have? Working with these cases on a day-to-day basis, it's clear to me that the Road Accident Fund in its current form is providing a form of redistribution mechanism to many of the South Africans that claim. Perhaps it is fraught with difficulty in terms of it being overly litigated, and if claims are not paid directly to claimants and so on and so forth. But those should be addressed directly. Proposing an overhaul to the system may disadvantage people who are currently benefiting as a form of social security. So we would like to say that we most definitely require updated legislation in general and for transformation purposes. But is RAPS really the answer? There have been previous recommendations that that could be considered directly in the current bill, in the current act rather. So for example, one of them is not listed there, but is the matter of compensation to be paid directly to claimants, whether by lump sum or annuity. Shorter claims periods. Currently, as a result of the system allowing litigation, there is an incentive to extend the period of litigation, which will increase legal fees. But certain rules could be brought into place that require documentation, extensive documentation, to be put forward to the fund within a certain amount of time, say 120 days, failing which the claim will not be valid. Also, to come back to the hybrid solution, as per slide 6 above, and just to potentially highlight that the new scheme is more complex and more administratively complex, rather, which could potentially exclude those who are not familiar with the system. I thank you, and I now pose it for questions or comments.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, there we are, short and concise. Honourable Ramatlakana, Honourable Sithole, Khaiduma ya tsamaya.
No, thank you very much, Chair. It is short presentation and a good presentation. It raises questions, some left unanswered. When we're preparing to ask these questions, it's asked to us. But I just want to understand the quick one, Chair, on the the question of cost on the you do say that no fault or fault scheme in terms of the cost. You on your slide number seven, that's when you talk about the hazard, moral hazard. I just want to find out from you the cost of fault, and has that been determined? Because no fault as it currently we want to run away from, it involves whole lots of intricacies, issues, including the lawyers. What is the cost to that as compared to the no cost aspect? And the no cost aspect, I think in your presentation you allude to the fact that the red light is more claims, that it may encourage more claims because there's no fault. Why is that the case? Because if it's a car accident and it's a claim in relation to an accident that in fact person suffers as a result of either hitting a tree or a lamppost of a car rolling or two cars meeting and cause of accident, there's a record of an accident. Otherwise, there will be this. If the ambulance is required to come on the scene, the ambulance will come. The police will come. It's a normal thing that there has to be occurrence book. There has to be a record on the occurrence book of what has happened. So why is this issue about possibility of increasing the claim becomes an issue, when in any case, in order for you to be able to pass the threshold or actually one test, is whether there was an accident or accident. So I just want you to explain that, and the fact that there's an issue about the cost associated to the no fault, which is basically untested. It's not tested. And tell me about the tested one. Yes. What is the cost on that one, in fact, in determining? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Member. I'll address those two issues. I think the first thing to clarify is the extent to which fault is currently being proved in the current system. So we have a current system which is incredibly litigious, where we attempt to establish fault. And that is obviously not sustainable, because that is not a value add to the system. So the alternative of a no fault is not necessarily more costly as such. What we are trying to highlight is that there are certain things that can establish fault and establish the nature of the accident through direct claiming with the Road Accident Fund, which would immediately remove the need for litigation. And that should be perhaps more closely looked at. So the need for direct claims, which Road Accident Fund does have the ability to do, but for some reason is not being utilized enough. So that is what we are trying to highlight there, that there should be encouragement of more direct claims to the fund, with appropriate documentation and so forth. And then that will alleviate the need for litigation, extensive litigation. And then the no-fault issue doesn't really come into the matter. In terms of the issue of increased number of claims, the fact that you have a litigated process acts to an extent to prevent people from claiming sort of just as a matter of claiming, because they can claim. So that prevents that. It's obviously untested, and it will be difficult to say if you move to a out-and-out no-fault system if you're going to increase the number of claims. But logic guides us that perhaps you will have an increased number of claims. However, that does not mean that the current system cannot work as a no-fault system, because if you have the appropriate processes at the Road Accident Fund and treat them as direct claims, and they follow the correct claims management process and claims assessment process, that can also help to reduce the costs.
Okay, yeah, just to follow up on the on the untested one, on the statement of the possibility, you do agree it's untested, and therefore to make a kind of a statement, a bold statement as of fact, doesn't quite really exist. And I mean, I don't understand the logic. Let's deal with the logic issue. I mean, the logic does say to me, for anybody to claim against the Road Accident Fund, there must have been a collision of there must have been a collision, or somebody must be hit by a car. So the question I don't quite understand is why this ringing of this bell, worried about that it will increase the claims, as if people will manufacture claims. You haven't said that, but I think let me stretch it there. It's almost suggesting that people will manufacture claims when they don't exist. But I'm putting to you that for anybody to pass the test, they should, at least in all accident, there's a police report. That is requirement, even including in terms of the insurance of cars. There is a test. You can see that there has been something. So why are you arguing this point in this way? So I'm just trying to really just understand it, because I think I read it as a scaring. Don't go there. There is a danger there. Well, nobody actually has seen any danger into it. And but what I like from your point is that you agree that a direct claim is not a problem. It minimizes the litigations, the high cost. So I agree with you on that point. So the last question, Chair, I'm going to be asking, if we can just make a note, is the link of the... Have you looked at what the commission of the judge, famous judge, has suggested in terms of the linkages between the social security network and what happens in terms of the accident road when you get to a particular age, that it should be linked, it should be sustainable, and it should be affordable. So just those two questions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. So just to close off the first issue of fault versus no fault, so I think we are generally agreeing on that matter. I think the reason the points being brought up is more closely linked to the need for a hybrid solution, because the benefit of having a fault-based system is where you can propose an alternative income for the individual versus what the fund is currently willing to provide, based on the set amounts that it would calculate. And this is where the potential issue lies, is that if you don't give the person who is due the compensation the right to propose an alternative compensation, if they felt that they've been disadvantaged, then you have a potential issue. So that is probably the underlying issue that we're trying to highlight, that a fault-based system gives individuals the right to propose an alternative compensation if they feel that they have been disadvantaged as a result of the accident, more so than the fund is proposing to them for compensation. In terms of the second issue of the recommendations of the commission, we support a need for an inclusive and holistic social security system. And we believe that the RAPS bill is able to provide that. What we are highlighting is that there are certain nuances of the compensation and how it works, and and those should be accounted for in the RAPS bill. That is our main highlight of that issue.
Thank you very much. Honorable Sithole.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the presenter. Chair, I'm trying to understand the word, because there is a statement that it says the higher accident and the higher unemployment may lead to a significant increase in claims. Your understanding, if you can unpack that one, your projection on that one. And the other one, Chairperson, is that one of the children turning 18 and 21, versus 21, because according to your statement, you say if that can be significantly increased or extended to 21 years, because the understanding is that the children which are 21 years, some will not be completed higher education, some, because of some circumstances, or either tertiary education. According to your statement, you say if that one can be 21 years, what does that actually mean? And the other one, Chairperson, is that one of the foster children. Because you said that should be included in the LEPS bill. Why do you suggest that? And what is your investigation on that one? And the last one, Chairperson, is that one of the widows. Because according to your statement, you say 15 years for widows should not be a case. They must actually extend it to normally retirement. If you can just unpack that. Thank you very much.
You can proceed.
Thank you, Honourable Member. I must admit I didn't catch the third item, but maybe you can remind me of that one. The first item was the potential for higher incidence of claims or more claims. I don't think that we are necessarily saying that there will be a higher number of claims. I think what we are trying to highlight is the impacts of that in the new system. So in the new system, it's a no-fault based system. So if you propose a claim to the Road Accident Benefit Scheme, the scheme will still encounter a similar amount of administrative costs to validate or invalidate that claim if it's a no-fault-based system. Previously, those costs would have been borne through litigation, and we're just trying to highlight that cost is now being moved to the scheme of vetting each of those claims. So we're not necessarily saying that there's going to be more claims in South Africa, there's going to be more accidents, but what we're saying is that the scheme itself will have to bear the burden of vetting those claims that would have previously gone through litigation. And if perhaps you are saying it's a no fault, you may have more of those because there would have been a deterrent previously for people to have to prove litigation, which may have acted as a natural deterrent. But that doesn't necessarily mean that those claims should not come to the Road Accident Benefit Scheme Administrator, because they are still valid claims. So that's just to clarify that point. In terms of children under the age of 21, I agree with your point that not all young adults will be able to benefit from higher education. So that's a point for discussion with the committee, with whether it feels that it's an important thing to allow for in compensation. I think coming back to the Actuarial Society's point of it should be at least until the end of the year in which they turn 18, I think that would be a reasonable sort of compromise. This was just to highlight that in current matters that the fund defends, two scenarios are often presented in any of these matters. One in which the child the end of the year in which the child turns 18, and a second scenario in which the end of the year in which they turn 21. And it's usually debated and discussed as to which is the most fair compensation for those individuals. So it's something to consider. The third item, I must admit, I did not hear. If you could remind me, please.
Honorable Sithole, your last item, if you can remind him what you were saying.
Thank you, Chair. My, according to their statement, they say there is a maximum claims period of 15 years for widows, which may be penalty for young widows who may not have the skill to secure employment. So they now recommended that that can be extended to normal retirement. That's what I was trying to check.
Thank you. Just to comment, we did not raise that as a specific feedback as part of our presentation, but I'm happy to comment on it. I think the reason for that feedback is that in the normal method for calculating compensation for a widow, we would calculate compensation up until the point that they would have normally received that compensation. So for a young widow who was unemployed, she would receive the benefit of his or her late widow or widower until their retirement, normal retirement. That would be the normal actuarial formula. And that's why we've given that feedback that we should replicate that in the new bill.
Chairperson, I am interested in the presentation where the presenter is suggesting a panel of experts. My question would be, where do they place this panel? Is it within the establishment, or is it an independent body outside? Is it independent of the establishment? And Chair, I agree with the Honorable Ramatlakane, because even if it's a no-fault system, but one has to prove that there has been an accident. I don't think they were making a point there when they say the scheme will be made vulnerable because of the high rate of unemployment. Because one, there are systems that are there for one to prove that there has been an accident. But I'm interested in this thing of panel of experts. And also the fact that the question that he is asking in the presentation, that is RAPS the answer? Because I think I would ask a question to him. Are there no gaps that they are seeing in the current situation that will result if we can address those gaps and also respond to some of the challenges that they are raising? Can't they say, go ahead with the proposed bill if we address some of your concerns? That's the issue, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. I'll address the first question of a singular panel of experts. I think this comes from the understanding of how the claims normally process for each of the claimant. So in any claim, you have panels of experts on either side of the matter. You have people proposing, or the plaintiff, and then you have people defending. So that, in terms of structure, is an expensive structure, because you always require to have two experts for every matter, which may not necessarily be required. So there are certain experts that that the fund, or the Road Accident Fund Benefit Administrator, can house internally, to address your sub-point within that question. where you have a singular panel of experts that assesses each claim. And that those experts can pull together a recommendation on the potential loss of income or loss of support of the claimant. And that could be used versus the current system where you have a double panel on each side. So if you could look at the current system, or if you could look at the new system rather, the proposed RAPS bill, and amend it to allow for some discretion where experts are allowed to provide an alternative income projection, that may then alleviate some of the concerns. That sort of leads into the next question, is RAPS the answer? I think the issue the actuarial society and Risk House is also trying to highlight is that you are potentially disadvantaging claimants who are earning above the average national income but below the cap, the current cap. These individuals do not have a right in the proposed RAPS bill to justify and prove that their loss of income is higher than the average national income. And that is what we would propose then, is that if you could accommodate for that within the bill, either through a panel of experts who have discretion or otherwise, that would then ensure a reasonable outcome.
Yes, Chair, but there's also one point that I forgot. Can he also talk more on the proposal on the post-retirement funding vehicle that they are proposing? Because the bill is suggesting that after 60, the SASSA benefits must kick off. What are you saying? Can you talk more on that? Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Honourable Member. I'm highlighting the need for retirement funding and for that to be provided for from the very beginning of compensation being received. The issue we have as a society is that, this is coming from an actuarial standpoint, is that all of us are not providing sufficiently for our retirement income. If you look at a motor vehicle accident and the impact that it has on an individual, it has an impact in the sense that it reduces their income earning capacity. But prior to the accident, they would have been required to provide for their retirement funding. And what the current bill is not allowing for is allowing for that transfer of that requirement. So once the compensation is being received, that compensation could be used for any purpose. And there isn't enough in the bill that requires part of that compensation to be set aside for retirement funding. Perhaps you have the SASA benefit at age 60 onwards, but that will not be sufficient on an individual basis. That may be sufficient for a population group, but there should be a requirement, and this should be provided for within the RAPS bill, where part of that income, a set percentage, you could recommend a range between 5 and 15%, for instance, if you look at the current SARS regulations in terms of what is being provided for retirement. And then that can be also housed within the RAPS administrator to provide for retirement. So you're providing a benefit to the individual, but you're also requiring them to set aside part of that benefit for their retirement funding.
Members, are there still takers? Would you assist us in maybe drafting just a one-pager on the retirement funding vehicle so that we are able to have an understanding of what will that entail, what will be the requirements for people to maybe
tap into the kind of a vehicle. A short recommendations for us on the retirement funding model vehicle.
Thank you.
Honorable members, it looks like there are no more takers. Let me thank you heartily from the portfolio committee for having made a presentation, indeed insightful a presentation. I think probably as we are making a presentation, I say, oh, these guys were comparing notes because what you're raising is what the previous actuarial society was kind of zooming into, meaning that we are becoming more and more cleverer and understanding issues of actuaries even better than we were this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Honorable members, we will take a 30-minute lunch break and then resume with our issues. You are very good today. Probably we'll finish even a bit earlier in this regard.
Zoom.